tales of secrecy and obsession.
One of the things I wanted to do in that story is to really forensically show in great detail how these prison gangs, and in particular the Aryan Brotherhood, which is undoubtedly the most murderous prison gang and probably one of the most murderous organizations in the United States and America, rose to power and how they operate.
That's journalist David Grann. We'll spend the hour with him today talking about his latest book, The Devil and Sherlock Holmes, and his first book, The Lost City of Z. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Life is infinitely stranger than anything man could invent, Sherlock Holmes once said. The strangeness of life is at the heart of journalist David Grann's new book, The Devil and Sherlock Holmes, Tales of Murder, Madness, and Obsession. It's a collection of 12 true stories. In them, Grann unlocks the mystery behind the murder of a Sherlock Holmes expert, goes with sandhogs deep into the depths under New York City's streets to warn about a terrifying threat to the city's water supply. He reports on the infiltration of the Aryan Brotherhood into the U.S. prison system. And he recounts the strange fate of Toto Constant, a leader of the Haitian death squads, and a man called the Devil by Haitian refugees. David Grann is a staff writer at The New Yorker. We spoke to him in 2009 about his first book, bestseller The Lost City of Z. We'll hear part of that interview later in the show. His latest book, The Devil and Sherlock Holmes, starts out with a story of a real person who lost his life over a fictional character. Richard Lancelin Green was the world's foremost expert on Sherlock Holmes,
who is found dead in very mysterious circumstances. He's garroted, and nobody knows exactly what happened. And he was garroted, at the time he was garroted, he was investigating, trying to track down a lost archive of papers by Conan Doyle, which he believed had been stolen. And in the pursuit of these papers, he begins to warn people that his life is in danger and that he is being threatened by a mysterious American figure. And then he is suddenly found garroted. And the case is taken up by all these amateur Sherlock Holmes sleuths, and who see this case as greater than anything, you know, more difficult than anything that Conan Doyle had ever written about in Sherlock Holmes. And so the story is really about both the obsession with reason and with literary and art of detection and trying to piece together stories. Richard Lancelin Green was deeply obsessed with Sherlock Holmes, so it taps into this theme of obsession, which is in the book, and this kind of fundamental need of ours to try to make sense of the world, to process the world like Sherlock Holmes. The difference is, and that's part of the point of this story and the point of all of these stories, is that none of us are Sherlock Holmes. Richard Lancelin Green isn't. I'm not as a writer. We are all mortal. We are all fallible. And so even though we try to piece together these stories perfectly, we can't always see everything as clearly. And it's what makes these stories real, and at least to my mind, more fascinating than a Sherlock Holmes story, which is in many ways like a fairy tale.
So are you saying that obsession, and I have to say, you're a pretty obsessive person yourself.
Yes. I mean, I'm fairly mild-mannered in almost every other form of my life, but when I do work on these stories, very much like the characters are trying to piece together the stories, I often become consumed with them, and I will spend more time and end up doing things I would not ordinarily do in pursuit of the stories.
So what is the nature of obsession? You're talking about a concept here where we can never see all the parts of things. Is there something that's innate in us that drives us to try to find out what is the mystery, and that it's not even the goal, it's the process?
I think it's both. I think that there is something deeply innate, very human in us. It's why I write stories, but why people tell stories, and why stories, whether you go back to the Bible, whether you look at literature during every era, there is a sense, an almost organic, innate sense of humans to tell stories, to move people, and to try to kind of fit the pieces of a puzzle, which is our lives. And that puzzle can be anything. I mean, it could be Richard Lancelin Green's puzzle, both of him trying to unravel who Conan Doyle really was so he can write his biography and discern where these missing papers are, and then people investigating his case to try to figure out what happened to him to kind of explain this inexplicable death. It can be like in another story in the collection about a fireman who lost his memory on 9/11 and all his men perished who he was with but him, and he's haunted by this question of why he alone survived and is trying to piece together what happened on that day. So I think all these things were all driven to try to understand our world and the world around us and to be able to kind of communicate it to us. So I do think that is ornate. I think that is our process. And I do think that the object is also often important as well, but we don't often or we don't always obtain the object. The object can be elusive, and that doesn't stop us. And so, for example, there is a story in the collection about scientists stalking the elusive giant squid, this almost semi-mythological creature with tentacles that are as long as 30 feet, some of you measured at 60 feet, with eyes that are the size of human heads. And I go out with this kind of with this giant squid hunter who spent his life trying to track one down, and it always remains just out of his reach. He gets so close so often, and that doesn't stop him.
Yeah, that's a very frustrating one. I that was one in which I really hoped he would find that squid, but he doesn't. And you, about the first story of Richard Lansland Green, I don't want to give away the ending because unlike a lot of the stories where I think, you know, you can talk about what happens, this one is truly a mystery. But I do want to ask you, were you surprised when you found out what really happened?
Yes, incredibly so. And one of the things these stories I hope they convey is when I begin these stories, I often know very little about them. I begin kind of at a flat beginning, the same way the reader does. And the stories are a journey. And often I think I may find X and I find Y. And in the case of that Sherlock Holmes story, I think it's fair to say that I found Z. I mean, I found something that I never, ever would have contemplated was the possible resolution to that mystery.
Now, in your book, The Devil and Sherlock Holmes, you've got stories like this, which are, you know, deeply individual and personal stories and fascinating in their own right. But you also tackle some social obsessions and mysteries. One of them that's really terrifying is about the most dangerous prison gang in America, the Aryan Brotherhood. Tell us, first of all, how did you get started in the story, and how did the Aryan Brotherhood get started?
Yeah. Like many of these stories, they begin often with just somebody, a passing reference in a conversation with somebody, maybe one line I find buried in a news brief. That was the case of the Aryan Brotherhood. I read basically, I think it was two sentences in a news brief in a local newspaper, a local California newspaper, saying that a prosecutor had arrested many leaders of the Aryan Brotherhood. Didn't know anything about the gang, didn't know anything about prison gangs. And I was intrigued about it in part because you're arresting people who are already in prison. So I thought, well, that's very interesting. You have people practicing criminality who are, in theory, should be being punished for previous criminality. And how do you stop that? And so I began to look into it, and it opened up an extraordinary secret world. And one of the things I wanted to do in that story is to really forensically show in great detail how these prison gangs, and in particular the Aryan Brotherhood, which is undoubtedly the most murderous prison gang and probably one of the most murderous organizations in the United States and America, rose to power and how they operate. And they began in the 60s, essentially during some of the racial upheaval in prisons, and initially had a racial bent. They started out in San Quentin, but eventually morphed into essentially just a criminal organization. I mean, even though its members are white, race is really secondary to them as time went on. They really were like an organized crime family that carried out hits in prison, extortion. They ran gambling dens. They ran drugs in and out of prisons. They controlled prostitution, sometimes selling off prisoners, and they were targeting some of the most people who, because they were targeting people who were already behind bars who aren't necessarily sympathetic, they never really got any attention, and they really rose and carried out their business for decades.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with David Gran about his new collection of true stories, The Devil and Sherlock Holmes. And tell us about the guy who began it. What kind of, and did you ever get to actually speak to any of them?
Yes, I did. And of all the stories I've worked on, the gang is a very frightening organization. In part because they operate in prison, and there are very few repercussions. A lot of these people, the authorities had tried to initially stop them by moving them and kind of dispersing them from one prison into other prisons, and all that did was to spread them into more prisons. Then they tried to move them into isolation, and even in supermaxes, they would use elaborate codes. They would, for example, use urine on pieces of paper that would then be sent out, and other prisoners would look at them with ultraviolet light and get codes telling them to do killings. They would also use bilateral codes, these very elaborate codes to communicate with each other. So because many of them are already serving multiple life sentences, they're really not afraid. There's not much that can be done to them. And so they're a very unsettling group. And I did speak with them. I was able to get their kites, which are their communications, their secret letters back and forth between each other. And I tracked down one of the most important defectors of the gang. And the gang has a blood-in-blood-out oath, which means if you want to get in the gang, you have to spill someone's blood, meaning murder. And the only way you can leave the gang voluntarily is to have your own blood spilled. You cannot just leave the gang. And this person had defected because at a certain point he felt the gang was just simply out of control. He was a very high-up member of the gang. And the gang started to target people outside of prison. They murdered the father of a member of the gang who had snitched, and he thought that was violating what he believed was the code. And so I tracked him down, and interestingly enough, something I didn't even realize existed until I did the story is that there's a prison witness protection program, which is essentially prisoners who have so many death threats on them, they are moved about, their details of where they're housed is never known, they're only listed as a number, not a name. And eventually I found this person. When I originally contacted him, the authorities thought I was a sleeper, meaning someone coming in to try to kill him, and they began to almost move him out of the prison. And then a law enforcement official called the prison and conveyed that, no, I'm really a reporter and I just want to communicate with him. And I went and sat down with him and was able to really learn about the inner workings of the gang from a person who had been in the gang, risen up, and become one of its top members before he defected.
And what was that like? I mean, as you say, this is one of the most murderous crime organizations in the United States, which is saying a lot, actually.
Yes.
What was it like to interview him? What was going through your mind? All right, he had defected, but still he had been responsible for a lot of violence.
A lot of violence. And in fact, when I met with him, he was not shy. He says, you know, I'm good at this. You know, I'm good at violence. And he described how he would study medical manuals in terms of being more effective at killings and stabbings. And he could do that almost methodically when he spoke. The thing about many of the gang members and the thing about this member I met is they are, by nature, usually very charismatic. The Aryan Brotherhood, unlike a lot of gangs, only recruits a very select few. They don't recruit the many. And the people who rise to the top are people who have kind of magnetic forces of personality and able to control people. And this guy was incredibly charismatic and incredibly smart and very well-read. The thing about many of the leading gang members is they go to what's almost called like an Aryan Brotherhood school, where they're given various books they're supposed to read on philosophy, from Sun Tzu to Nietzsche. They have a whole kind of training program, teaching program, philosophical program that makes them, they've created a kind of theology, a culture to the gang that makes people feel a part of something and gives them a philosophy on both how to rule and to rule often with impunity. So he was strikingly charismatic and smart, and then at moments when he would describe how he would kill people and how he was very good at it, it was quite unsettling. And I was very happy that there was a partition between us. You don't get ordinary prison visits with these guys.
Yeah, it's almost a kind of Hannibal Lecter sense about this.
Well, I mean, yes. I mean, in fact, one of the most famous members of the gang, this guy named Tommy Silverstein, who on a single day, the only time in prison history, along with another member of the gang, killed the prison guard, and then another guy killed the prison guard. The only day ever that two prison guards were killed, they were killed within hours of each other. And he had killed already in prison, and for years he has been essentially kept, they've created almost a separate prison for him. It's like a Hannibal Lecter place.
One thing that I really had trouble with in reading this particular chapter, The Brand, about the Aryan Brotherhood, was how difficult it was, as you mentioned before, to control them. And I guess I'm wondering if there's really something about the prison system in the U.S. that in some ways makes it so difficult, something structural that, you know, if we had a different kind of system, it wouldn't be so easy for them to hold such sway.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an expert on the prison system, but I definitely came away with that impression from reporting on this story, which is that there has been almost a tacit, trying to think of the word, it's almost like a rapprochement where the prison guards have said, okay, we'll protect the exterior of the prison. We can't let you escape. That is our job, and we want some order internally, but they have essentially allowed these, what I would, they're almost like warlords. It's almost like you're going to Afghanistan, you say, okay, I want order, and you're willing to make almost these tacit deals with these warlords if you kind of control your segments of the population. And so a lot of these gangs have really been able to flourish internally, and so I do think it's been a real problem. I mean, in some of the cases, there has been overt complicity where some of the guards have been got caught up in the gang. But that's probably on the smaller side. Instead, I think there's almost just an acceptance and almost making do. And I think it's been a real problem. And like I said, the people being targeted because they are not ordinary citizens, because most people don't care about them, because most people don't see what happens, it doesn't get the level of concern when there are these murders. But as the prosecutor who took on this case, a guy named Greg Jessner, just because you are sentenced to stealing or robbing a car or whatever it may be, it doesn't mean that you were sentenced to die, to go into a prison and be killed. And so his quest is a very interesting quest and a very interesting struggle. He's one of the first times that a member of the authorities had really tried to take on the gang.
And there was some measure of success, at least up to a point.
Yes, and there was. And how, you know, it certainly made a dent because there's so many systemic problems, as you were alluding to earlier, how much you can stop these things, I just don't know.
Now, another really terrifying story in your book, David Gran, the book is The Devil and Sherlock Holmes, Tales of Murder, Madness, and Obsession. And this is your chapter called City of Water. What you say in there is that almost at any moment, the New York City water system could go down and it would take months or years to bring it back up.
Yes. But one of the things I try to do in these stories is to take people in the secret world. And in the case of The Brand that we were talking about, it may be a secret world because it's very criminal and very dangerous and it's rarely ever penetrated. In the case of the story City of Water, it really takes you into what I consider almost an invisible empire, which is that there is an invisible empire underneath Manhattan that is as elaborate as the city skyline, but one we never see. And what it is these incredible, intricate maze of tunnels that extend for thousands of miles, like all, and then they go up to aqueducts to the Catskill that bring water into the city. And these tunnels have been built for over a century, and they supply, there are two main tunnels that supply New York City and the surrounding boroughs with all of its water. Now, when these were originally built earlier in the 20th century, they had valves that were supposed to be shut down. You could shut them down and go in and repair them. Unfortunately, because of an engineering glitch, they could not turn the valves. There was too much pressure, and they were never able to shut down these valves. to close off segments of the tunnel so they could then repair them. So these two tunnels were built to be repaired periodically, and they have not been able to repair them. And they are leaking and hemorrhaging water extremely badly. And they are all potentially on the verge of a collapse in various points. And so there has been a race starting in 1969 to build the third water tunnel, a major water tunnel, that they could then get online and shut down some of the other tunnels and repair them. And this tunnel, as I said, it started being built and constructed in 1969. It's not set to be completed until at least another decade. It's one of the largest and most complex engineering feats in the history of the world. It rivals the Panama Canal or the Brooklyn Bridge, but it's never been seen. Already, at least 24 people have died building it, which is about, they estimate, usually about a man a mile dies. And so there is this race to complete this tunnel by these sand hogs, these generational tunnel diggers. They come from the same families, which is very interesting. And often their fathers and their grandfathers were the ones who built the earlier tunnels.
And I have to say, I want you to describe what it's like for them. You went down with them. Reading about this, I thought, oh, my God, what a horrendous job. And yet they take great pride in it. Tell
they
us
do.
About
they
it.
Take great pride in it. And I really respect and deeply, you know, in the book, you meet a whole sort of characters and, you meet people like the Aryan Brotherhood who you be happy never to see again. And then you meet people like the Sandhogs, who I deeply admire. These guys are tough, very brave, very courageous. People don't know about their work. They're doing very complex work. They go down as deep as the Chrysler building is as high. They go down as deep as 1,000 feet. They take these elevators down. It gets darker and darker. Standing in the shaft, if it's icy outside, just even a broken icicle, if it comes down and hit them, if they weren't wearing a helmet, could kill them. And they then bore out using explosions or what is now, in newer days, they often use a tunnel boring machine, which is just kind of an extraordinary mechanism, almost impossible to describe. I mean, it's got these huge cutters, and it extends, for yards. And they basically explode through bombing and through this tunnel boring machine, basically muck out these enormous tunnels. And it's very dark, it's very damp, it's very cramped, and noisy. And I am not claustrophobic by nature. I really don't ever get scared in a tight space, but I went with some of them with this tunnel boring machine, which has these enormous blades that presses against the rock, cutting it. Periodically, the blades get worn down, so they have to cut out the blades. They have to replace the blades or clean the blades. And they crawl through the machine, and then they stand in an area that's only about 2 feet wide with water up to their waist, staring at these blades that would, cut you in a second. I mean, they're cutting through rock. They would slice your body up in a second. And I went with them, and I remember standing them when I was staring at the blades saying, "All right, guys, I think I got to go." And they just said, no, just another minute, and I really was claustrophobic. And when we came out, I was covered in mud, and one of them clapped me on the back and used a little bit of profanity, which I won't use, but he just said, "Welcome to our world."
Now, you've said a race since 1969.
It's a long race, right?
Why is it taking 50 years?
Yeah, I mean, it really shouldn't have. There's been funding issues. When it got started, it was right around the time when New York went bankrupt and had all its financial crisis. And so there were financing issues. There's often problems with neighborhoods. While they all want the tunnels, they don't want to hear any of the possible explosions. You sometimes can feel the repercussions above ground or the noise from the cranes lowering things down and equipment down. And so often you have these kind of neighborhood battles to allow the tunnel to proceed, even though it's vital. Everybody kind of not in my backyard syndrome. And so there have been delays along the way that have held these things up. But they are now really making progress, and they've completed a major segment of the tunnel. And if all goes well, hopefully by 2020, we will see a lot of this tunnel operating.
Wow. And, of course, if one of those tunnels that one of the two tunnels that now exist goes down. Oh,
it would be cataclysmic. And I think people forget how vital water is to our lives. And one of the things I did on researching that story was discover that, you know, New York often, and like many cities, actually didn't used to have water. Water was like a major crisis for centuries, which is why they started to build these tunnels. And because of lack of water, you had, for example, the Great Fire in New York, which just, you know, burned, you know, huge swaths of the city because the firemen didn't have water. They had to try to run to the river to get pumps in, and because of a lack of water, you had major fires. You also have, which people forget, is diseases. Without water, you live in an extremely dirty, disease-infected, bacteria-infected area, and so disease was like cholera epidemics. I mean, so there are huge stakes. I mean, our notion of what a world looks like without water, I kind of was trying to imagine it, and then I actually just read historical textbooks, and I said, oh my God, this world already existed. And you can actually see it and envision and read what happened.
Yeah. One of the most terrifically reported pieces in this book, The Devil and Sherlock Holmes, is the story you tell of Emmanuel Totoconstant. He was, you could almost say, a death squad general from Haiti.
That's right.
Who came to the U.S. Haiti's been much in the news, and this is a real reminder of why Haiti is so underdeveloped and was such a victim of, you know, that the earthquake was not so much a natural disaster as it was a human-caused one, as many people have said. He's one of the most notorious figures in recent Haitian history. Tell us who he was.
Yeah. Totoconstant was head of an organization called FRAP. And FRAP essentially means like to hit, and they would, when they would salute each other, they would slam their fists into their hands, and they were essentially a paramilitary death squad. They were the heirs to the Tonton Macoutes, which maybe some listeners have heard of from the Duvalier days. Duvalier was the dictator in Haiti for many years, and his son, and they were a very brutal paramilitary squad, which was operated during the 1990s in Haiti, and were allegedly responsible, and I think the evidence certainly bears out, responsible for countless deaths and rapes of women and murders of citizens, Haitian citizens, and kind of rule with terror. And Tonton was Totoconstant was this kind of unlikely leader because he was a very kind of literate and kind of gentlemanly in demeanor. He walked with a cane. He was somewhat dashing in a way. And he almost seemed like an aristocrat, but he was the figure and the leader of this gang. And in Haiti, he really was known as, you know, the Devil, which was his nickname. That's what he became known as, the Devil. And that's part of where the title of my book comes from. And he eventually, mysteriously, after the U.S. invaded Haiti in part in the early 1990s with Clinton, or the mid 1990s, because of the brutality of the regime and the brutality of FRAP, he was able to mysteriously end up in the United States and live in New York, and he lived in Queens for many years, among the very people he had targeted and victimized, and many of them began to actually stalk him, and part of my story was to unravel, both to explore his life and this strange situation of an exile living among exiles, where he was like Cain, who was constantly reminded of the crimes he had committed by seeing these people, but also, and more importantly, is why was he allowed to live in the United States? And one of the things I uncovered is that he had, when he was in Haiti, had ties to the CIA, had received money, and that FRAP had direct links to the CIA, and at least it appears that he was able to get assistance to enter into the United States because of those ties, and was given this, what at least some of the people in the immigration, when he was initially arrested, let me just backtrack one step, he was initially arrested after he got into New York because the Haitian government was so outraged and said, you can't let this guy run the streets, and you got to bring him back so he can face justice. And he was arrested, but then he threatened to reveal the secrets, his ties to the CIA. And at that point, he was suddenly released and allowed to live in New York.
Yeah, and he did that, I believe, on 60 Minutes. He basically threatened to spill the beans. So how did you find out just how important an asset he had been with the CIA?
You know, that was a story that took a long time. I was able to obtain a lot of declassified documents and also to get a lot of people involved to speak who hadn't spoken before. I spoke to people, for example, even in the immigration who were in charge of his case when he had been arrested, and one of them said, you know, this is off the charts what was happening. He was outraged at the time. He could not believe that they were allowing this man who had murdered all these people onto the streets of New York, where he was both a danger to society and also where society was a danger to him, because Toto was threatened by many of the locals who were out to, you know, many of them had lost family or loved ones because of him or because of Frapp. And so, in fact, there were many incidents I discovered when he was living in Queens where neighbors would surround his house. They would put up wanted posters on the streets. They would chase him from jobs he would obtain. So it created an incredibly fraught, dangerous local situation in the middle of New York.
David Gran. We'll talk more about his new book, The Devil and Sherlock Holmes, after the break.
Qu'on voit danser le long des golfes clairs à des reflets d'argent, la mer des reflets changeants sous la...
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Before the break, we were talking about the Haitian death squad leader Emmanuel Toto Constant. He was eventually tried in Haiti for his crimes, and David Grand went there to witness the trial.
I went with Toto's lawyer, who was defending him when he was being tried for essentially one of the massacres, where several people had been killed from this village. And one of the things that really struck me when I was there was the case was a real test case for the Haitian judicial system, where they were trying to show that they could prosecute and come to terms with some of the sins of its past. And in one of the back rows, there were sitting all these people neatly dressed. They were the victims' families. And they had walked, you know, often miles to come to this little trial that was held under a billowing canopy. And they had dressed up as if they were attending church. It was such an important thing to them. And one of the things that was very saddening to me is because I had arrived with Toto's lawyer to cover it, many of them thought I was affiliated with him. And at one point, one of them came up, and before I could explain anything, kind of spat at my feet and walked away.
And his lawyer is, there was a conversation that you recount there that he had with somebody else in which he was questioning the veracity or the truth of the trial because he said, well, you know, because there was some forensic evidence from bodies that had been uncovered that was being presented. And he said something that was really pretty shocking. He started talking about it. He said, well, you know, if this had really happened as a massacre, these bodies wouldn't have been found.
Right. He would have been dumped in a different place and not along the beach, and the acid would have gotten them. And it was a very important trial. It was the first time, and I was there when this happened, that any kind of forensic science, genetic science, was ever introduced into a Haitian courtroom. And they had some of the bones there and had done various kind of forensic evidence to use to link to the victims. And many of the bodies, in fact, were not found because they were buried or washed out to sea. And so, but there was that very conversation, which I found, disconcerting, which I tried to replicate in the story.
And disconcerting because, it was obvious that this guy knew how Frapp had functioned.
Yeah, that's true. No, and how you get rid of bodies and the casualness, the way it was being talked about, too. I mean, essentially what they were saying is they didn't do it because they would have been more sophisticated.
Right.
You wouldn't have seen anything. You never would have found any evidence.
Yeah. Another thing that shocked me, you found a Justice Department memo entitled Emmanuel Constant Options. There was Jamie Gorelick, Samuel Berger, and other pretty high people. Tell us about this memo, and what did you think when you found it?
Yeah, this was a declassified memo. I was able to get a cover letter, and what it did is it showed how high up and how every agency and the top members of every agency discussed this issue of what to do with Total Constant when he suddenly threatened to tell tales, which he did with me very, very detail about how he was essentially some form of an operative for U.S. intelligence. And what's interesting about that memo is it gives you clues to who was involved, and I tried to get several of them to talk. I spoke to Warren Christopher, or I spoke to his assistant, tried to get him to communicate, and he said he didn't have a memory, he wouldn't speak. And some of the details of some of these memos are still classified. So I was able to gather clues who was involved, and then in talking to people, got some sense, especially when I tracked down this immigration official who was in charge of Toto and eventually had to release Toto, was the one who gave him the news. And he just said once Toto started to sing or threatened to sing, people just came out of the woodwork, and the people that came out of the woodwork went to the very top of the U.S. government.
Wow. And so he finally did end up in jail, but not for any crimes that we would consider.
Yeah, I mean, you know, a life, and that's what makes these stories true and very unpredictable. I mean, you know, if you asked me how that story would end when I finished it, in fact, you know, at that time I thought a little bit the way I think Toto thought, that he was either going to somehow return to Haiti in another coup. He was marshaling his forces and thought that if there was another coup in Haiti, he would be brought back and returned to power. Or perhaps he would have ended up with his blood spilled in the middle of Queens by some victim who had been targeted by him and his organization. Instead, several years later, not too long ago, he was arrested in an enormous real estate scam. He had become a real estate agent, and the subtitle of the piece is the Death Squad Real Estate Agent. And he was selling real estate in the middle of Queens to these people. Some of them, he would go into their houses, and they would look at him in shock and terror, saying, "Is the devil in my house?" But he was convicted of frauding lenders of more than $1 million.
And he got a pretty hefty sentence.
He got a pretty hefty sentence, and finally his contacts were not able to protect him. And I think it was Cuomo, who was the Attorney General of New York, said at the end that Total Constant will no longer be a threat to us.
It's just so ironic that he could go away for 37 years. I mean, that was a sentence for, I mean, you know, real estate scam, yeah, people got hurt. But after all, it's money.
Yeah.
But he could not be put away for murder and rape.
No. And I do think, it's kind of amazing. And I think there was some, even with this prosecution, I don't know enough. I do think there was, you know, clearly at a certain point, Cuomo and the local officials decided to just proceed on their own course. Here was a man whose organization, along with the Haitian military, is believed to be responsible for more than 3,000 deaths.
Well, David Grand, your book is The Devil and Sherlock Holmes, Tales of Murder, Madness, and Obsession. As always, it's a terrific read. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you so much for having me on the show. I really enjoyed being here.
Next up, we hear part of our 2009 interview with David Grand about his last book, The Lost City of Z. It's being made into a movie starring Brad Pitt as Percy Fawcett, the explorer who disappeared in the Amazon in 1925, looking for the ruins of a lost civilization in the heart of the Amazon jungle. Percy Fawcett was the last of the great Victorian explorers. Called the David Livingstone of the Amazon, he ventured into uncharted realms with, David Grand says, little more than a machete, a compass, and an almost divine sense of purpose. When Grand began his quest to find out what had happened to Fawcett, little did he imagine that he would find himself in the Amazon jungle, engaged in the same mystery that drove Fawcett to the ill-fated 1925 expedition from which Fawcett never returned. Like the explorer, Grand went in search of El Dorado, or, as Fawcett called it, the Lost City of Z, a place, skeptics said, that never existed. Whether Fawcett himself ever found it will never be known. When I spoke to David Grand, I started out by asking him to tell us something about the explorer.
he really was the kind of last of a certain breed. He grew up in the Victorian age, and he was really this kind of the last of these, both the Victorian, but also these amateur explorers and archaeologists who would venture into these blank spots on the map with little more than a machete, a compass, and an almost divine sense of purpose. And he began exploring the Amazon in 1906, and the Amazon at the time was really the last large blank space on the map. And for nearly two decades, he explored this area. And at the time, if we saw one explore that many of the countries in the interior, like Brazil and Peru and Bolivia, they didn't even know where their borders were, and so they needed someone to come in and map them. And so that's how he first started exploring the Amazon. He then continued to explore it for nearly two decades. And during the course of that time, he began to gather clues and evidence that suggested to him there were remnants of an ancient civilization in the middle of the jungle. And in 1925, he finally set out to find it. And discover it, and he brought with him just two people with him. He brought with him his older son, Jack, and Jack's best friend, Raleigh Rimel, and off they marched into the wilderness, and they then vanished without a trace. He was a very larger-than-life figure, and even though he's not remembered by that many people today, he was once this kind of titanic and colossal figure who really was a legend. He would take these parties into the Amazon and usually take about, you know, a dozen men with him. This is before he disappeared. And usually half his men would die of disease and starvation. Others would be killed by tribesmen. And yet he would always manage to survive. And this kind of fueled this legend about him. In 1912, long before he even disappeared, he helped inspire Conan Doyle's novel, The Lost World. And he's a man of many contradictions. He was undoubtedly one of the most daring men ever to explore in the Americas. He also could be merciless to those he was with. Because he was always immune to disease himself, he had very little sympathy or pity, and he was almost maniacal. And he would drive his men through the wilderness in just really kind of these very oppressive conditions. He was also in many ways very progressive for his time period, especially in the way he interacted with Native Americans. He refused to let his men fire on the Indians under any circumstances, even when they were being ambushed. And once, in kind of mad Victorian fashion, he had ordered his men to drop their weapons and sing God Save the Queen as he marched forward into a fusillade of arrows.
And he escaped unscathed.
He escaped unscathed, and it fueled his own sense of invulnerability, and as well as the others' people's sense of his invulnerability. I mean, he almost had, by the end, a god complex because he was able to survive under so many extreme and difficult circumstances. He really adapted many of the methods that the tribes used to survive in the wilderness. And by the end of his life, really lived almost like an Indian warrior in the jungle. He would paint his face, and he had begun to use all sorts of herbal medicines. And this really allowed him to survive when others couldn't in this area. But it also in some ways contributed to his death because he really thought that nothing could touch him. And in 1925, when he went to find the city of Z, he was already 57 years old, which was very old to be going on an expedition like this. And it also led him to the folly of bringing his son with him as well.
In The Lost City of Z, Gran has horrifying descriptions of the sheer physical agony the explorers went through. I asked him to read a passage from his book.
So this is a reading that takes place. It's actually describing Fawcett's first major expedition into Amazon, which happened in 1906. And he brought with him about a dozen men, including a second in the command, a man named Chivers. And they were at that time trying to map the interior. Now, the Amazon is about the size of the continental United States. It's an enormous space. And again, because it was so unexplored, even the countries in the interior didn't know precisely where their borders were. And so they had sent Fawcett in to try to map this interior, and it was really seen by many outsiders as a suicide mission. And they encountered on this trip many predators for the first time, wild pigs. Even a frog, which is about the size of a coin, has enough toxins in it to kill 100 people. But I'm going to pick up here and describe really what was the main threat to this expedition and to other expeditions that Fawcett went on. But it wasn't the big predators that he and his companions fretted most about. It was the ceaseless pests, the Sauba ants that could reduce the men's clothes and rucksacks to threads in a single night, the ticks that attached like leeches, another scourge, and the red hairy chiggers that consumed human tissue. the cyanide squirting millipedes, the parasitic worms that cause blindness, the Burney flies that drove their ovipositors through clothing and deposited larval eggs that hatched and burrowed under the skin, the almost invisible biting flies called piums that left the explorers' bodies covered in lesions. Then there were the kissing bugs, which bite their victim on the lips, transferring a protozoan called Typanoroma cruzi. 20 years later, the person, thinking he had escaped the jungle unharmed, would begin to die of heart or brain swelling. Nothing, though, was more hazardous than the mosquitoes. They transmitted everything from malaria to bone crusher fever to elephantiasis to yellow fever. Mosquitoes constitute the chief single reason why Amazonia is a frontier still to be won, Willard Price wrote in his 1952 book, The Amazing Amazon.
And you also talk about something called candiru.
Yes, the candiru is it's a little tiny fish. It's a little toothpick-like creature. It almost looks like a toothpick. And it is a real scourge. It's often known in Brazil as the vampire fish. And what it normally does is it latches onto fish. It's almost like a parasitic creature. And it latches and burrows onto fish and lives off them. But it is also notorious for getting into various human orifices, including a male's penis. And it will lodge in the tip and block it, and it kind of latches on. And if it's not removed surgically, the person will die. And Fawcett had described seeing people facing amputation or even dying from it. Reading the diaries of Fawcett's companions was one of the more interesting and also kind of shocking and horrifying experiences I had during the research of this book. And I tracked down many diaries from his companions, including one man named Murray, who was a great polar explorer. He was a biologist. He'd actually gone with Shackleton on an earlier expedition. And he teamed with Fawcett, believing the Amazon would be easy compared to the brutal conditions of the cold and snow. And yet, as he went into the jungle, he was soon kind of under constant siege. And one of the things that he was invaded with were these little maggots, these almost parasitic worms. They would burrow under the skin. They were deposited by flies. They would then hatch. They would then burrow under the skin, and they would grow, these little worms, and they would poke their heads out of their skin. And when you read Murray's diary, you see him slowly going mad. I mean, basically, he had always studied microscopic creatures, and now his body was literally being taken over by them. And he could just see literally more than 100 of them moving in and out of his skin.
And this was the environment that you decided to go yourself.
It wasn't one of my wiser moments, and it didn't happen immediately. I became interested in the story, and I began it in a way that was much more suited towards my limited physical attributes, which was in the archives of libraries. And I had gone around the world looking for diaries like this and trying to basically tell Fawcett's story and the story of these quote-unquote Fawcett freaks, all these other people who would go in search of Fawcett or in search of Z, and they would also disappear or die. But as I was doing this research, I became more and more consumed by the story. And at one point, I had gone to Cardiff, Wales, where I tracked down Fawcett's granddaughter, a lovely woman named Rolette. And she had led me into her house, and we chatted for a while. And when I explained to her my interest in Fawcett, eventually she said, "Well, do you really want to know what happened to my grandfather?" And I said, "Well, sure, if at all possible." And she'd led me into this back room she had where there was this old chest, and she opened up the old chest. Inside were all these old books, and the bindings were disintegrating, and they were covered with dust. And I asked her what they were, and she said, "Well, these are my grandfather's logbooks and diaries." And she allowed me to go through them, and they had enormous clues about where Fawcett had actually gone in the jungle. And he had always been extremely secretive about his route because he was afraid that one of his rivals might beat him to his discovery. And suddenly I was in possession of this knowledge about where he had actually gone. And it was really at that point where I decided to do something that, again, was very out of character for me because I am the least likely explorer in the world, which was to plunge into the wilderness and see if I could solve this mystery myself.
Did you encounter any of these horrendous conditions yourself?
When you're in the jungle, I mean, a lot of the jungle has been deforested in areas where Fawcett went, and I was quite surprised to see some sections of the forest where he described cutting through tents and dense forest, and the forest was so thick that he at one point got separated from his younger companions, and some of these areas were literally cut down. But as we move further north into the area where Fawcett disappeared in the Brazilian Amazon, the wilderness really remains and is unchanged in many respects, and there we certainly encountered many of the same conditions. Now, I had the benefit of many immunities and shots and elements of gear that Fawcett could never have imagined. I mean, I had various inoculations, but inevitably you encounter many of the same conditions that he did as well.
Today, some of the forest Fawcett had written about has been cut down, but I asked David Grant to tell us what the Amazon was like at the time Fawcett explored it.
The Amazon at the time when Fawcett started exploring the area was 1906. Again, it's an enormous area. It's about the size of the continental United States. And because of the impenetrable nature of the forest and also so many of these threats, especially mosquitoes and diseases, it had really remained largely unexplored. And so it was this last large blank space on the map, and it really had for years and centuries haunted the Western imagination. And when Fawcett came into this area, partly because it was during the period of the Amazon rubber boom, rubber had become in great demand, and because of that, and rubber was tapped in the Amazon, and because of that, rubber barons would send in their men to try to enslave the Indians as workers, or if they got in their way, to massacre them. And so because of this, it was an extremely bloody period on the frontier. Many of the tribes had retreated deeper and deeper into the forest to preserve their cultures and way of life. And even once friendly tribes now often ambushed interlopers because of that and justifiably defended their territory fiercely. So this made Fawcett's explorations doubly treacherous because he had to head into these areas. And there was very little known about many of the tribes in this area. Even today, the Brazilian government estimates there are about 60 tribes that remain uncontacted in the Brazilian Amazon alone. Back then, it was certainly a much larger number, and Fawcett was the first white man to make contact with many tribes in the Brazilian Amazon.
Now, you go in the book into the attitudes towards race, towards Indians. In fact, the idea that such Indians could never be capable of the kind of advanced civilization that Fawcett, Percy Fawcett, believed that they had at one time. What were those attitudes, and why did Fawcett think differently?
Yeah. When Fawcett came of age during the Victorian age, he grew up then, and he was filled with all the very prevailing racist attitudes, which were extremely dominant at that time, to the extent where Indians were seen not only as inferior, but there was even questions about whether they were subhuman. And many of the early anthropologists from Fawcett's day, they would be sent out with chronometers, various kind of tools, like measure the size of the Indians' heads to basically try to determine their inferiority of their intelligence. And so Fawcett had been essentially taught that the Indians were incapable, almost biologically, of constructing an elaborate or complex society. And gradually over time, a second theory emerged in the 20th century that pretty much lasted up until very recently, which was environmental determinism. First, it was biological determinism, which kind of basically said people, because of their biological makeup, were incapable. And then later, the second theory that Fawcett combated was environmental determinism, which basically said that geography, that societies are captives of geography, and that certain conditions would simply prohibit a complex society. And the Amazon was seen as one of them, that the conditions in the jungle were simply too brutal to develop a large enough population to sustain a complex society with divisions of labor and political hierarchies. Now, Fawcett, over his nearly two decades of exploring this period, had begun to gather clues that led him to believe that these assumptions, both about the jungle and its people, were mistaken. He encountered many tribes that had not before seen white men before, and he was always struck by the complexity of their culture, the richness of their traditions. He also found that many of them had much larger populations that was originally assumed, that essentially disease from contact from settlers had wiped out many Indians and led to false assumptions about whether there could have been large populations in the jungle. The other thing he once found was he was in the Bolivian floodplains, and he was climbing these large earth mounds, and there were several of these earth mounds spread out. And when he reached the top of one of these earth mounds, he saw something sticking out of the ground, and he bent down to pick it up. And it was a shard of pottery. And everywhere he scratched, he saw other shards of pottery. Now, this was in an era before carbon dating, so he couldn't determine its precise age, but it struck him as extremely old and very refined. And that wasn't all. When he looked out between these enormous earth mounds, he saw buried under the undergrowth what looked to him like straight lines that were roads and causeways. So these were some of the clues he began to gather that led him to believe that indeed the Amazon had once contained remnants of a great ancient civilization.
Modern historians think the epidemics of disease brought about by the conquistadors to the vulnerable indigenous people of the Americas may have been responsible for wiping out their great civilizations.
When the first conquistadors went in to look for what they believed was an ancient civilization in the jungle, a place called El Dorado, which they'd heard about from the Indians, and it was said to be so plentiful in gold that the inhabitants ground the metal into powder, they blew it through hollow canes upon their naked bodies until they'd be shining from the head to foot. Well, this clearly inflamed the conquistadors' greedy minds, and off they went into the jungle to try to find this place. And during those trips, thousands died. During the first El Dorado expedition, some 4,000 men died of disease and starvation. And other parties descended into cannibalism, some went mad. And after time, most people concluded that El Dorado, or a complex society, was no more than a delusion. And they dismissed the accounts of the El Dorado hunters. Now, even though the El Dorado hunters had not found their great golden kingdom, they had all described in the early accounts, these are the first conquistadors who had entered the Amazon, they had all described seeing large populations, enormous settlements, big roads and causeways, bridges, lots of pottery. Now, most historians had dismissed these accounts as simply the products of the conquistadors' fervent imaginations because later people came and didn't see these things. But Fawcett thought the accounts were too similar to slowly dismiss. And now what we are learning is that essentially these accounts probably were much more truer than we ever thought, and that the rapaciousness of disease was so strong that these larger populations were quickly wiped out. And it was something that Fawcett speculated in his writings. He thought that the population had been decimated by disease, and that was one of the reasons nobody had found evidence of these settlements. And the decimation of the population was so large that Fawcett even wondered, because you know he couldn't even quite wrap his mind around it, you know, had there been some kind of natural disaster as well.
Of course, while civilizations fell, the people remained. Grant spent time with the Kikurus, a tribe that may have descended from a great civilization deep in the Amazon. They live in the area where Fawcett disappeared.
That is the area where Fawcett disappeared, and it's the area where Fawcett believed he would find his ancient city, and it is in that very region, right near this old settlement, current settlement of Kikurus today, where Michael Heckenberger has found all these ancient settlements, and indeed the descendants of these people are still there. Their numbers are much smaller, and what's interesting is they have oral legends which have little details about these grander, larger ancient settlements. For example, one of the things that Michael Heckenberger has found is that in the ancient settlements where the ruins are, there were these great moats, almost like these defensive ditches built all the way around. They would extend for more than a mile in diameter around these settlements. And at the base of these moats were palisade walls, were these holds where they had constructed these palisade walls going all the way around. And the current settlement, the people no longer have that, but in one of their oral histories, in some of their oral legends, they have details of these moats, and they have details of these palisade walls. Now, they thought the spirits had built them, but there is this connection between the present and the past that you can still find there. And one of the amazing things in this area is the Kikurus really have done a remarkable job at preserving their traditions, and you know, you can witness them even while you're there.
David Gran in 2009. The Lost City of Z is currently being made into a movie starring Brad Pitt. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.